from somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our special guest tonight, legendary teacher John Taylor Gatto. By the way, special hello to you, Tracy and John, out there in Colorado Springs, just making power during the night shift for everybody in that area. Good to have you aboard. Back in a moment. Sometime tonight, John, I want to talk with you about Darwin and creationism, but also tell us a little bit about the book Dumbing Us Down that you've written. You're offering a special deal for Coast to Coast AM listeners, and I wanted to get that out right now.
Oh, good. What I'm offering is a very special deal on my latest book. That's The Underground History of American Education. It took 10 years to write, and it's as long as three long books. It's 335,000 words, so you can throw it at rats if if you get angry at it. Anyway, it's a big book, and it's packed full of facts and the documentation of those facts. And we've just raised the price to $35, but if you'll mention Coast to Coast when you order it, I'll do two things. One, that you can have the old price of $30 on Underground History of American Education, and I'll include a cassette of one of my most popular lectures on the scientific management of children. We charge $8 and $10 for this cassette, but if you'll mention, you've got to mention Coast to Coast, because this is not a generic offer.
Right.
If you mention Coast to Coast, you'll get the $8 or $10 cassette, and you'll also get $5 off the book. Now, you
and order the cassette's free. You're saying, right?
The cassette will be absolutely free.
Okay.
So, if you have a computer, you order at 212. Okay,
hold on,
sorry.
Hold on.
You order at my website,
right,
which is www.johntaylorgatto.com. I'm going to spell Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and Gatto is G-A-T-T-O. That's www.johntaylorgatto.com. And remember to mention Coast to Coast, because no one else gets this deal. Now, if you don't use the Internet, you can fax the order to 212-529-3555, and you only have to include five pieces of information: a credit card number, your name, your address, your telephone number, and the expiration date on the credit card. That's five pieces of information. And for those of you who don't like or don't use the Internet for whatever reason, it's 212-529-3555. I have a third offer, again, only to Coast to Coast listeners. I speak all over the world and all over the country, and I'll offer $500 off my speaking fee if anybody out there has an organization that would like to hear from me in person. I have to warn you that from January through March, I'm touring Europe on a speaking tour, so I wouldn't be available until April, May, June, and on through the rest of the year. But you can ask for that on the website or through the fax if that interests.
Great, and we'll get all this information out next hour as well, John, okay?
Thank you, George.
You get a lot of speaking engagements abroad, don't you? Why? Why do they tap into an American teacher for
it's
this?
It's amazing. It really is amazing, and once again, my merriment is because I'm partly baffled, but I have a hypothesis. For example, I've spoken for the Chinese government in Beijing several times. I've spoken for the Singapore government three times. Down in Colombia and South America, I've spoken for the government. In almost every case, I have to sign a paper saying that I won't tell anybody, so I apologize for having broken that that silence. However, there's such a repetition of similarity in the in my encounters that here's what I think it is. That all of these countries have adopted a U.S. style of schooling, and some of them are pushing it very, very hard. As a consequence, they're getting the same kind of pathological behavior as we're very familiar with all over the United States from school kids. In Singapore, for example, the family unit's breaking down. And why not? School is resolutely anti-family. And you can see that the reason's purely political. I mean, it's other things, too. But political's enough that you can't have a secondary source of authority and have any efficiency in indoctrinating kids. That's why schools are anti-religion as well. There are other reasons, but you can simplify the contents of your mind by simply saying they can't allow an alternative source of wisdom to influence the kids, so they have to run down these other sources of authority. I believe that it's because I'm telling the factual truth, and nobody, and I mean nobody, around the country or the world, including school administrators, can get this information without putting themselves in jeopardy, even asking these questions. So also, I made ghetto classes work very well, and we hear all the time that we need lots more money and attention and love to make them work. Well, those are nice things. We don't need those things to make them work. We have to understand the difference between an education and a schooling. And kids are desperate to get an education, although they may not be able to articulate that in words. And they despise a schooling because they understand instinctively what it is. Let me tell you, an 11-year-old boy, the son of two Taiwanese immigrants from the West Coast, told me what school was about. And did we have a moment,
yeah,
George?
Yeah, sure do. 11 years old, you're saying.
11 years old and not even born in this country. He said, it's the trapped flea principle.
Now, what did he mean by that?
I said, what? What do you mean? He said, this kid was scientifically oriented. He said, when you put fleas in a shallow dish, they'll jump out. But if you put a lid on the shallow dish, when they try to jump out, they'll hit their heads over and over and hurt their heads. So when you take the lid off, they won't ever try to jump out of the dish again. I almost fainted as an 11-year-old boy. His name's Andrew Tsu, T-S-U, to give him credit for that brilliant idea.
How true. You know, when people say, we can't move into this town, they have a lousy school system, what do they mean? I mean, are the teachers all bad? Are the buildings decrepit?
Well, a lot of it's a social class thing. I mean, a lot of it's, observation of riotous behavior and a little bit of its examination of the text and the teachers and the physical plan. But the truth is that there's virtually, that's a virtually universal pronouncement. Do not be fooled by a quiet, attractive interior, and smiling teachers.
Good point.
Every state in the union is under the direction of the higher levels of the system. I don't want to sound conspiratorial. You can track these things easily to their sources.
You could build a brand new school with state-of-the-art equipment, and it could be lousy for education.
Oh, God bless, George, of course. If it isn't lousy for education, I can tell you there will be federal inspectors come around, and there'll be people come around from different authority groupings, and they will make it very, very hot for you, including from the local political clubs who get the main source of patronage they have to distribute from systematic schooling.
Take this back a little bit, too. Though we're concerned about our kids in school and the way they're being educated and taught, what about our teachers who are going to college to get educated so they can teach?
Of course. The colleges not only are in this thing over their necks, but the colleges derive 30% of their total income, coast to coast, from teaching courses that provide teacher credits for certification. They're not allowed, you can see. Now, allowed, I don't mean someone comes around and says you're not allowed to do this. You just pick that up immediately. I, in fact, taught in a prominent New York university for 5 years, and I was the highest-rated member of the education department, and it had 164 people in it, and that's pretty big. Let me tell you that I did not get tenure. I didn't get tenure because my kids operated in a vastly different fashion than the other class kids did. And I was considered a danger to the school, even though I had no interest in waving my fist in the air, throwing mud at buildings. I just showed them how to liberate the educational passion of kids. It isn't even very difficult to do, but it's almost impossible to do inside the structure of systematic schooling unless you have a principal and a superintendent who are themselves saboteurs. But that is so scarce that don't count on that.
Well, John, you've hit it on the head. And one thing, when you were named the New York State Teacher of the Year, in your opinion, why did you get that? What were you so good at?
Well, you know, what's really fascinating, George, is that there were 38 judges, and a large number of us appeared and presented our credentials before this 38-member panel, each member representing some power interest in New York State. Not one of them thought to ask me how I got these effects. The record my kids ran up was just astonishing. It's still today, 20 years later, it's an astonishing record. But anybody could have done it, George. So I'm not patting myself on the back. They didn't ask me how it was done. And, of course, I did it by breaking the law flagrantly. I never violated the trust of parents. I always would go to the parents' homes every year, and we would talk over strategies for liberating this individual kid or that individual kid. And as a consequence, my kids were always in the newspapers, on television. They started businesses that made tens of thousands. These are 13-year-old kids, you know. And before you say, well, you know, he's a rare teacher like Jaime Escalante, that's nonsense. Pick up a 100-page book, The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and you will see how Franklin educated himself at the age of 12 and 13 hundreds of years ago. I said, well, if Franklin can do it, I mean, I read that in college, and I guess a lot of you have. But I read it. I didn't read the words and pass the test on it. I read it. And here this guy is putting himself through an education at the age of 12 in colonial Philadelphia that I guarantee you no Harvard, Yale, or Princeton freshman or sophomore would dare to tackle today, probably not through the whole college career.
Right.
And yet it doesn't cost a penny.
Is it still appropriate now?
Oh, it's absolutely appropriate. The elite private boarding schools of the United States, there are only about 300 of these places, and there are really only 20 of them that count. I'm sorry, I don't want to break your heart if your kid's going to one of the...
And what do the parents pay for something like that, John?
Well, the funny thing is they pay a fortune. But, George, what these schools do doesn't cost a penny. Half of my secret was simply adapting these principles of elite private education to a public school classroom in Spanish Harlem. And after, I'm not going to say it works instantly, because first you got to get the kids to trust you. Every
right.
teacher says, this class is going to be different. None of them are. But once they see that they're going to have the opportunity for an education, and remember, they wouldn't put it in those words, they will lend themselves enthusiastically to exactly the same kind of education that Groton or Andover or Hotchkiss produces.
That are costing thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a few specifics so this isn't just rhetoric. And if you get the book, you'll find this in detail and much, much more than we have time for tonight. All of these schools aim for a strong competency in the active literacies. Now, notice that term has completely vanished from the public imagination, and yet 100 or 200 years ago, it was very common. In colonial America, it was against the law to teach ordinary people the active literacy. So what are they?
It was against the law? Really?
It was against the law. In Virginia, it was a serious crime that in British Virginia, a serious crime to teach ordinary people the active literacies. But in fact, it was discouraged everywhere. So what are the active literacies? Well, think of it this way. No matter how well you read and how highly developed your mind becomes, if you can't communicate well enough to recruit allies, you're no danger to anybody. The active literacies are public speaking and writing, and without those, you have a narrowly circumscribed life, regardless of what field you enter, including the sciences. Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I made television a central part. I said, ignore the text, the substance of what anyone's saying. Watch how they say it, and you will get a first-class rhetorical training for nothing at all. Watch how they accent things. There's not ever a flat reading. Nobody survives on television or in radio who doesn't accent words in a dynamic way. You can figure this out. I mean, kids learn this in two or three days, and they go from being, klutzes and nerds to being pretty darn effective speakers.
I had a speech teacher, John, in the University of Detroit. His name was Henry Schneiderman. What a wonderful guy he was. And he said, hey, George, read this. So my first reading was The Man Went Down the Road, and he came up to me in front of the class and said, you want to go into broadcasting, you want to be the best at what you're doing, and you read like that? And I said, well, what was wrong with it? And he would watch me, and he went, the man went down the road. And he said that one word in that sentence changes the whole perception of what you did.
Sure.
And I learned from what he did.
It's sort of like riding a bicycle, a two-wheeler, until you can do that. I mean, it seems fraught with danger and something only the big kids can do, but the instant you keep your balance going down a hill, you never fall off again, unless you're nuts. Similarly, what my kids would do, and remember, to a large extent, these were ghetto kids, not exclusively, also had some the sons and daughters of some very wealthy people, but these ghetto kids would sweep the boards in public school and in writing competitions. Let me tell you.
I know. You pulled some miracles, John. Hey, we got to take this break. But let me tell you something. Now I know why you've been named the New York City Teacher of the Year on three separate occasions. We should have you as the head of, Department of Education, quite frankly. You need a cabinet position. We'll be back with John Taylor Gatto in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll chat a little bit about the creationism and Darwinism, get his thoughts on what the schools are doing with that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to talk with legendary teacher John Taylor Gatto right here on Coast to Coast AM. And let me give you some information, by the way, where you get a free CD, Art Bell's interview on Mel's Hole. When you subscribe or renew the After Dark newsletter, go to 1-888-727-5505 or online at coasttocoastam.com. In addition to that, if you would like the After Dark CDs, two of them, 2.5 hours worth of ghost stories and great material, you can call toll-free at 800-598-2331. That's 800-598-2331. Or that is right under Hot Stories. You'll see a link up there, coasttocoastam.com. Hey, John, before we get into Darwinism versus creationism, get your thoughts on that. In all your history of teaching, was there that one student that came in a disaster and left where you were just so proud of him or her?
Oh, absolutely. I would say there was hardly a year when that didn't happen. Once you connect a kid with his or her own power, and I'm not suggesting that's easy to do, but it isn't so hard to do that I don't think everybody has a fighting chance at that. Once you connect them with their own power, they don't want their time wasted. And they understand that they have this narrow window where they're free to explore and to learn how to use their minds, and then they're going to be in the pressure cooker. It's just a fabulous thing to see. I would tell my wife, I only taught, I don't know if I should say this, but I will. I taught originally on a borrowed teaching license. New York didn't require a photograph.
Uh-huh.
And so in between advertising jobs, where I intended to get rich, or at TV commercials, in between ad jobs, I borrowed a teaching license and started to teach. I became so intrigued by the tremendously exciting responsibility that you get. You know, most jobs don't give you any real responsibility. You do your trick, and then you go get drunk. So I would say to my wife, I can't wait to get in there in the morning to find out what these kids are going to teach me. It was like having 120 extensions
yeah.
onto my own mind. It was really is a thrilling thing to do. I mean, it's very depressing also if you don't have a fighting spirit.
Absolutely. It could break you down.
Oh, the system will break you down. And the kids will break you down as long as you do the system's work, because you're actually mutilating them. You don't mean to, but you are.
They hate the system, don't they?
Well, just take the idea of uninterrupted time. It's one of the great privileges and pleasures of anybody's life, but one of the principal weapons of mass instruction employed by compulsion schools is the destruction of uninterrupted time. Schools are rat maze of activity, bells, loudspeaker interruptions, unannounced messengers or visitors, toilet interruptions, going and coming, distractions by unruly kids and from the street outside, and the effect of losing unbroken time is absolutely enormous, just enormous.
That's it. You are right. It is.
I mean, without it, there have been. I hate to cite scientific tests, because the ones that come from university laboratories are mostly faked in order to keep the work. But there have been such a wealth of these investigations into what happens if you interrupt somebody's attention often enough. It turns out eventually that the people can't synthesize the information they take in. And if the bells and the knocks and the disembodied loudspeaker voices and the flatulence imitating sounds impinge on your concentration often enough, and I don't see how you could avoid that, it becomes hard to make sense of anything, even if the distractions are brief. Remember from history that it only took one knock on his door to make Samuel Coleridge forget what he had planned for the second half of his famous poem, Kubla Khan, so it remains a fragment today. Think of Isaac Newton under a tree figuring out gravity by himself from watching apples fall. Or if you read about how Watson and Crick actually discovered DNA, it's fascinating. They were screwing around cooking things in an oven with a window, not for scientific purposes, but just to take a break from what they were doing, and they saw something that didn't add up. You need this time. And institutional schooling has conditioned parents and a lot of kids into a dread of idleness. Even though if academic results are the measure, these schools actually do very little. It's hurry up and wait, as you say in the army, so that's one of the weapons of mass instruction. There are dozens of them, and once you've adjusted your mind to see this way, to see that this is an engine designed to produce two things: one, to produce customers for the mass production economy, people who are so bored and can't initiate their own lines of meaning that they buy things constantly in order to relieve this feeling of boredom. Mm-hmm. And then in a secondary but still important sense, it's to condition people to work in these huge pods doing one thing over and over again until they drop dead or their teeth fall out.
you are so right on the money, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you, George. I take that as a high call.
Hey, let me take a few moments this hour, what's left of this hour, before phone calls next hour, and that'll be it for you. I've used you for 3 hours then. Darwinism versus creationism.
Yes.
Why is there such a controversy going on?
Oh, well, it's a lovely question, and thank you for asking it. This took me about 6 years to work out down in dusty library stacks. But let's start with a few facts that none of your listeners, or very few, will ever have heard. Darwin's first ambition was to be a minister of the state church of England. And he, in fact, went entirely through a theological school training. What's interesting about the state church of England is that you can't get, and for hundreds of years couldn't get, any preferment unless you were a member of the state church of England. And what did the state church teach? Well, you can go to the Book of Common Prayer and find the homily of obedience, which says flatly that everything from the lowest insect to the highest king is put in that place by God, and God doesn't want people to get out of their place, so that you have this perfectly organized divine system. Somewhere along the time of Mr. Darwin's boyhood, this idea that these placements were divinely ordained began to wear thin, and that jeopardized the social and economic structure of the most powerful country and countries on earth. So what came along was Mr. Darwin, who said exactly the same thing, only now it was scientific. Mm-hmm. Put big quotes around that. Remember, he was trained as a minister, and he said that biology had put everything in these precise places, and that's where they were supposed to stay. And then in his later book, Descent of Man, he said that if these things got out of their place and the good stuff crossbred with the bad stuff, evolution would march backward into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. I mean, that's pretty creepy. Now, I'll tell you something about Darwin that absolutely a tiny handful of people, no one else knows. Darwin was spectacularly wealthy. You won't find that in any text.
No, I didn't know that.
Spectacularly wealthy. He had the Wedgwood fortune, the China, and in those days, that was the high-tech, high art everyone had to have if they were going to be. So Darwin's associates weren't the man in the street or the woman in the street. They were kings and dukes and earls. Darwin's family was in the inner circle of the British throne.
It sounds like he loved being there.
Well, imagine what he now offers not only to the crowned heads of England, but of Germany and Europe and as far away as Japan, George. What he offered was a perfect scientific justification to nail people into these boxes that we call classes, not by accident, and it's justified. You're protecting the advancement of the human race. Now, obviously, you don't tell parents that, and you don't tell principals or superintendents that, but you can live with yourself. You can look in the mirror and say, well, we've got all the bad stuff locked up. And it's John Calvin, the great theologian in the 16th century, said, there's so many of these bad people, or the reprobate, he called them, that we're going to have to teach them to police one another, because there's not enough of us to lock them in place so they won't cause trouble. Now, let me tell you something else that nobody, I mean, nobody seems to know about Mr. Darwin. First of all, he was the cousin of a guy named Thomas Malthus, who's taught in every freshman biology or sociology course in college, and in some high schools, too. Malthus said that people were breeding faster than our power to feed them, and that there was no way ever that food increased arithmetically, he said, 1, 2, 3,
mm-hmm.
but people increased geometrically, 2, 4, 8, 16. So he said that the human race will put itself out of business unless some way is found to give these
exterminate us?
Well, he said that they should be given short, brutish lives, because that was actually a kindness, since there was no room for them, that if you shortened their life by working them to death or stressing them to death, you're actually doing them a favor.
See,
now
that's always been my theory of what these globalists want to do with all of us.
Oh my God! Look, your listeners should not believe that they heard John Gatto say this. Just go to Malthus's essay on population. It's in every library in the United States. It's in every college in the United States. Just read it. He's quite a clear writer. He says there's no way out of this except working and stressing these people to death. Hey.
That's what they're doing to us.
But that was Darwin's. So Darwin, he was older. So Darwin grew up looking fondly on cousin Malthus, who was already being considered the friend of the establishment mm-hmm. across Europe. Now, Darwin's first cousin, slightly younger than himself, was a person called Francis Galton. Now, he's less known, but not unknown at all in college courses. Galton is considered widely to be, by psychometricians, people who measure the quality of mind, or at least pretend to, he's considered to be the single brightest human being who ever lived. This is Darwin's cousin. And what Galton did was to create a pseudoscience called eugenics,
oh my,
which taught how to keep the bad stuff in its place. And then he came to the United States a number of times and anointed various heads of the eugenic mission.
Ooh, so he started this.
He not only started it, he invented the whole idea of reducing all of the growing up time to numbers, to formulae based on numbers, to lock people in their place with numbers, because politically, then you can, and socially, you can then justify, well, look at this kid's numbers. We can't let him go to college, et cetera, et cetera.
Amazing. Just amazing. And it started so long ago, yet it continues.
Well, it continues, and people should understand again, because I'm absolutely certain that there are people who are in on the continuation. But you don't need that to be true. All you need to do is set up a system of incentives and disincentives, and the thing will perpetuate itself forever. And, of course, that's what we've done through the licensing system. All of the various licenses, which extend down to bus drivers, mind you, those were the work of Andrew Carnegie and the Carnegie Foundation, of John D. Mm-hmm. Rockefeller, of the Rothschilds in Europe. The whole idea was to reserve these privileged occupations for people who played ball. And you could do that by setting up licensing commissions. And you would tell the public, this is to protect you, but it actually is to protect the system.
Interesting. Like lawyers, doctors, everything.
Let me prove that to your listeners. And you say, well, how can you prove it with just words? Well, let's take the standardized tests. Now, you hear people say that they're the core and the strength of a sane, rational system. And you've heard John Gatto say that they don't measure anything at all. But I'm about to prove to you, whoever you are, that you believe what I just said, and here's how I'll do that. Have you ever, in your entire life, gone to a barber and asked him what his grades or his standardized test scores were?
No.
How do you judge a barber? Well, you look in the mirror and you say, well, you dumb, et cetera.
Blankety blank, yeah.
Have you ever gone to a doctor and asked him what his standardized test scores were or his grades? Let me tell you what you would have discovered if you had gone to the current president of the United States. You would have discovered what he told a Harvard audience about 3 years ago, that he was the best evidence that a C student could make good. So you'd find a C student, and in terms of standardized tests, you'd find somebody quite mediocre, 550 out of possible 800 on the verbals.
Mm-hmm.
However, rather than being someone who's here to run down George Bush, let me tell you something about his opposite number in the first election, Al Gore. Al Gore flunked out of college the first time, and at his second college, he graduated with C's and D's as his average. Let me tell you something about the legendary Senator Bill Bradley, who graduated from Princeton with no trouble.
Mm-hmm.
His standardized test scores were exactly at the median of Harlem kids. It was so low that it's embarrassing to say what it is, but not the lowest of all, the legendary senator from, I believe, Wisconsin or Minnesota, Paul Wellstone, who's recently
the late Paul, that's right.
All right. Mr. Wellstone graduated with a combined score on his SATs of 800. Now, in those days, the maximum was 2,400. And you don't have to be too good at math to figure out that he got a 33. I mean, really, I could go on.
What does this tell us, John?
This tells us that these tests measure nothing of value except there's not an opinion. There have been 80 or 90 studies that have cost millions of dollars attempting desperately to prove that these tests correlate with anything else. They correlate with exactly one thing, and that is your score on the next standardized test.
All right, stay
that
with us,
John. They correlate beautifully on.
Stay with us. We'll be back with John Taylor Gatto. We'll mention his book and this offer just for you. And guess what? Phone calls now, because you've been trying to get in for an hour. We'll do it when we come right back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.